Welcome back to the show. This is Jen Rubin. This is Jen Rubin's Green Room. So as we sit here on Tuesday, I must admit I'm somewhat stunned. Not only is Donald Trump in court on 34 counts of falsifying business documents, not only are we hearing testimony from one David Pecker to talk about the catch and kill, in other words, the attempt to cover up Trump's extramarital affairs and shut these women up. But, and this is what's truly frightening, we have someone who refuses to abide by the judge's orders. The judge has told him he cannot threaten witnesses, he cannot threaten jurors, and that's what Trump has done over and over again. Even after the DA filed his motion to show cause, even after he knew that this hearing was coming, Donald Trump refused to follow that. He must attack. He must be aggressive. He must be in control. And he's going to pay a penalty for it. The judge may not put him in the pokey this time, but he's going to fine him and he's going to warn him. And mark my words, I think he's going to wind up behind bars for some period of time. Maybe it's just an afternoon, maybe it's overnight, because he doesn't accept anyone's authority. He will not follow the rules. And his lawyer tried to make every argument and, of course, got nowhere, wound up pissing off this judge something fierce. When a judge says to an attorney, "You're losing all credibility with me," woo, that's scary. And the trial's only just begun. There are 1,000 other decisions he's going to make. And if you already alienated the judge at this stage, you're in big trouble. So the judge is not buying any of this. He's not buying the lawyer. He's not buying Trump's excuses. And right now, there's a test. Is Donald Trump going to defy the power of the court? That's what he's been trying to do all along. He doesn't believe in the rule of law. He doesn't believe in the authority of courts. And it's up to Judge Merchan to remind him and remind the country that everybody is subject to the rule of law. He cannot defy the court. He cannot threaten people. He cannot try to scare jurors into leaving the trial, as he did with one juror already. So it's going to be a test of the legal system. It's pretty serious stuff. And although this is not, if you will, the point of the trial is the charges. It's very much the point of putting Trump on trial, because we're really testing the rule of law. Are we going to live in a system where one guy, because he's a bully and he's an obnoxious authoritarian, gets to do whatever he wants because he was once president? And that's really the test for Judge Merchan. It's amazing that this responsibility falls to a state trial judge. But that's where justice is made all over the United States, at the trial court level. Now, this week, we're also going to have the Supreme Court hearing the immunity case. And I have to say, do not forget to be outraged. You should be outraged even before they decide this, because of the way they have helped grind his trial. This is the January 6th trial, to a halt. They could have simply affirmed the D.C. District Court decision. They could have heard this on a very expedited basis and already have issued their opinion. But they've done none of those things. They sent Jack Smith back to the circuit court. The circuit court heard the case, issued a unanimous, very compelling opinion. Then the Supreme Court said, okay, we'll hear it, but not until April 25. And mark my words, they're going to wait until the last day of the session before they issue their opinion. And we better hope it is so clear and so determinative, because if it is a 14-part test with 3 subparts, and Trump gets to litigate how that test is applied, and then appeal back up the system to test whether Judge Chutkan properly followed the rule, he is not going to get to trial before the election. And that would be a huge miscarriage of justice. The Supreme Court has no business selectively pushing and compelling certain issues like Dobbs, for example, like immigration cases, like the 14th Amendment case, to the front of the docket because they want to rule in a certain way and they want everyone to get there quickly, and taking another case and doing their best to slow it down and drag it out. They have their foot, their arm, their entire bodies on the scales of justice. And it's infuriating, it's inappropriate, and it goes to the heart of why the Supreme Court has lost its credibility. They are no longer impartial, objective enforcers of the law. They are partisans. They are Trump partisans. And that's got to end. So I certainly hope that Thursday's oral argument makes clear that there are at least 5 votes for a clear, decisive opinion that's going to leave Trump still going to trial sometime this summer or maybe in the fall, and the American people get at least a partial look at what the January 6th charges look like and what he has done. Because after all, aside from the rather stunning and offensive things that he did that are coming out in the New York trial, his greatest sin was against democracy. His greatest betrayal was our American democracy. And that really should get its day in court. Liz Cheney, as she often does, said something that was exactly on point. And what she said in an opinion piece in the New York Times was, it cannot be that a president foments an insurrection and we cannot deal with it in the criminal court system before he runs for office again. She's right. We shouldn't be in that position. And if the Supreme Court puts us there, it will be, I think, a disastrous day for the court and possibly for our democracy. So, speed, thoroughness, some spine for our judicial branch. We need it all, and we need a quick opinion. So, keep tuned this week, next week. The following weeks are going to be absolutely critical to see whether Judge Merchan and that jury, 12 ordinary people and 6 alternates, enforce the basic concept that the rule of law applies to everyone. If you have been watching, listening to any of the coverage of Trump's trial in New York, you may be somewhat slack-jawed, not only at the substance of the trial, but the fact that he is so defiant and so unwilling to comport himself with the court's orders. Donald Trump does not like to be told what to do. He's the one who tells other people what to do. And I think that sort of encapsulates the entire phenomenon of Trump, which is that he is an authoritarian personality. He's a bully. He expects people to follow. He does not think the rules apply to him. And I think that's both a political judgment and I'm beginning to think a personality judgment as well. And we have the perfect person to talk to us about that today. John Dean was a legal advisor to President Nixon, went through the Watergate proceedings. He's written books on Watergate and on government, but he also has made a study of both authoritarian leaders and authoritarian followers. And this seems exactly the topic that we should be talking about. So, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I have to ask you before we get into other topics, what your impression of Trump on trial is, how that compares to Watergate, how it differs from Watergate. What's your sense of things?
Well, Trump on trial in New York, where at the heart of the case is payoff of a porn star, is something I cannot envision Richard Nixon ever being involved in. It's just beyond my abilities to conjure. So the whole thing kind of disintegrates from there on. And I just know that Nixon had such a different appreciation of the rule of law. He really actually believed in it. What's happened with the Trump presidency is we understand that Nixon wasn't as bad as we thought he was. And he actually had some strong suits. And one of those was he wasn't a bad lawyer.
Right. And after all, he accepted a pardon from Gerald Ford, and Gerald Ford pardoned him, suggesting that all of this talk about immunity is something that Nixon never would have approached. Was that your sense of things as well? He understood that the president was not completely immune from whatever he had done?
I don't think the Nixon thought he had any immunity whatsoever. I think he understood that there was a common understanding, a sort of comedy between presidents where predecessors did not go after their successors, particularly in the area of national security. There are too many instances where you have violations of law that are well known later. As I think about the court now trying to mold some sort of immunity defense for an official act of a president. First of all, I don't think they have any business doing it. They're not the institution that should do it. But if they were to do it, obviously in national security, and which are very official behavior, you have countless examples of presidents breaking the law. I think of Bush Cheney, who authorized torture. That's a war crime. Obama could have theoretically gone after him. He didn't. He just let it alone and moved on. And that's typically what has happened in the past. I think it's what should happen in the future. We shouldn't try to codify in any way these understandings and working relationships that are part of our democracy. And that's certainly one of them.
Interesting. And obviously, you could use other examples, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and the lies about Vietnam. There are scores of other issues, and we've really never had to delve into that issue. Before we go to a larger topic that I know you've written and researched, I want to get your sense as a court watcher, what you think the Supreme Court is going to do on immunity.
Well, I'm concerned mostly, I guess, that they're going to delay it or send it back to a lower court to determine if some sort of official actions were involved in some way, and in other words, further fact-finding before they actually grind out a decision on whether there is any kind of immunity or not, which would be a tacit victory for Trump, because it could push all these other trials to way after the election, and theoretically election that without that knowledge, Donald Trump could win. I think he's less likely to prevail, and certainly with the most thinking people don't want a deeply compromised person in that office, and he is that. So hopefully that's not the case, that they will bite the bullet. They actually should accept the D.C. Circuit, which is a powerful and excellent ruling, and leave it to others to decide if there should be any kind of presidential immunity. It's not something this court really, as well briefed as this is prepared to do. So I'm, as a court watcher, I've read a number of the briefs. I think one of the most powerful one was done by the scholars of the founding era, who made an overwhelming case that the founders never envisioned any kind of immunity, criminal immunity, for the presidency. And it's all but stated in there that they contemplated a president could be, in fact, it came up during the constitutional debates, that the presidency was very subject to criminal prosecution once that presidency ended.
I want to ask you, since you have become a student of authoritarianism and authoritarian personalities, what you've learned, first of all, in your study of people who are close to authoritarians, people who are in positions of power and somehow wind up simply getting sucked into a magnetic personality. What did you observe during Watergate, and what lessons do you think that has for us going forward?
Well, working at the Nixon White House is when I first became fascinated with these personalities. I just noticed they thought and acted a lot differently than my mental processes, and they seemed to accept at face value whatever the leader said. And I was just not so inclined. And that's where it all started. And it was actually years after leaving where I began reading the literature about authoritarian personalities that I discovered these are people I know. These are people I worked with. And it started a process of understanding there are really two ways to approach authoritarianism. And our social sciences do it in two ways. There are the political scientists and historians who look at the way authoritarian governments operate. Then I found a whole other larger school even that look at who are these people that are attracted to authoritarian leaders. And this is a studies that started in the mid-40s following World War II and what had happened in Italy and Germany, and some of the Eastern European scientists, particularly the Jewish scientists who've been forced to leave and come to the United States, most of them here in California, began looking at the type of personality that was attracted to authoritarian leaders. And they came out with a work that was at the time somewhat breathtaking called The Authoritarian Personality. And they it was very controversial because it was deeply rooted in a lot of Freudian psychology. And social science doesn't embrace Freud as much as some of the other medical sciences were at the time. And it started a process where they later, social science would take the Freudian approach and actually document through interviewing and testing of hundreds upon hundreds of people and their personality traits to develop a science that is now well-founded and has been largely ignored until Donald Trump arrived on the scene as far as the public commentary on it.
So what are some of those personality traits that this branch of science has documented? What are some of the characteristics that we should look for?
Well, I actually started writing about it quite by accident. When I went to secondary school, I went to a private school, and my roommate was the son of a U.S. senator by the name of Goldwater. In fact, yeah. He was the namesake of Barry Goldwater the Third. He and I had became lifetime friends, and of course, I got to know his father when I was about 12 or 13. And really knew a very different man than has been publicly portrayed. I had long conversations with the senator, and both when I was in Washington and after we both left Washington. And one day during the Obama years, I took up a project that I had started when he was still alive, where he was in a fight with the religious right, with Jerry Falwell. And he was telling me that he said, John, I said, I just don't understand how these people act the way they do. If these preachers ever take hold of the Republican Party, we're in trouble. And I think I'd like to write a book on that. And if you'd help me out on it, I'd be more than willing to share my name and what have you. And we came up with a title called Conservatives Without Conscience, which pretty well defined this type of personality. And it was at that time that I took my first deep dive into the social science of authoritarian personalities and authoritarianism. And it was, unfortunately, for the project, the senator got ill, and actually Barry Jr. called me and said, he's really not up to the task. He said, why don't you put it on the shelf and come back to it when he's feeling better? And I said, that sounds like a good idea. And so there was like a 10-year gap in the project when I did not forget about it and continued to gather information about it, and then during the Obama years did a book called Conservatives Without Conscience. When I pulled it all together and at that point I sifted through all of the major studies and then found one fella who had done probably some of the real groundbreaking work, was an American who was teaching up in Canada, a fellow named Bob Altemeyer. He and I will later collaborate in a book, but when I did the first book in 2006, he was very helpful in understanding a lot of the studies, and he's extensively quoted in that book. But anyway, I, at that time, Jen, to get around to answering your question with that long preface, I sort of teased out what were the personality traits of the two leading schools of authoritarian personalities, and they break down into the personality who jumps out in front and says, "Follow me." They're known as the social dominators, and the other type are right wing authoritarian followers who want to be told how to think and how to behave and what to do, and they're not self-starters necessarily like the social dominators. Then there actually is a third group that, as Altemeyer told me once, with typical creativity of social science, we've come up with the label calling them double highs, because they test highly on the scoring on both these testing systems, and we can't quite figure them out. But they are the most dangerous, because what it appears to be happening is they're social dominators who take the right-wing follower test, and they score high on both because this is the way they believe everybody should act. And they are the ones who are most likely to be the most troublesome. But anyway, in the process, I went through and looked at what these people say themselves about their personalities. And if you look at the social dominators, they're typically men, they're dominating personalities, and they oppose equality, and they're desirous of power, and almost always amoral. In addition, they have intimidating and bullying style. They're faintly hedonistic. They're vengeful. They're pitiless. They're exploitive. They're manipulative. They're dishonest. They'll cheat to win. They're highly prejudiced, meaning sexist, racist, homophobic. They're mean-spirited. They're militant. They're nationalistic. They tell others what they want to hear. They'll take advantage of suckers. And they specialize in creating false images of themselves. Well, of course, when Donald Trump came down the escalator, a man I really had never paid any attention to in my life, and I had earlier written this book, so he came down the elevator when in 2015.
Right.
I'd done this book in 2006 and 2007. Wow, he just suddenly filled the image with the exact type of personality I was following. So right. My next question was, how many people would be attracted to this fella? And those are the so-called right-wing authoritarian followers. And their personality traits is they're both men and women. They're submissive to authority. And they're aggressive on behalf of the authority to which they're submissive. And they're very conventional people. They are believers. They're often highly religious. They have moderate to little education. They trust untrustworthy authorities. They're prejudiced. They're particularly homophobic, and they don't like women necessarily, their followers, or any other religion than their own they're opposed to. They're also mean-spirited, narrow-minded, intolerant, bullies. They're zealous, they're dogmatic, they're uncritical toward their chosen authority, they're hypocritical, they're inconsistent and contradictory, they're prone to panic easily, they're highly self-righteous, they're moralistic, they're severely punitive, they demand loyalty, and they'll return it, they have little self-awareness. Anyway, those are the two big broad categories,
right,
excepting the small number of those who test high on both scores, on both scales.
Now, the book, of course, is a clever play on words because Conscience of a Conservative was a book of the old school of conservatism, that conservatism was a set of beliefs. Now, what you have described has nothing to do with the ideology of conservatism, limited government, rule of law. It's an entirely different animal. So when people talk about conservatives, it's really inapt when you're talking about Donald Trump and his followers. I wonder if in any of your research on your first book or later, you came up with any thesis. Let's talk about the social dominators first. Are these people born or are they made? In other words, have they exhibited all these qualities their entire life, or are these people who get into power and then develop this kind of profile?
Very key question. Question I have been asking since I first discovered these people and the fact that social science looks at them. I have would ask back in the mid-2006 period when, or 2005, and when I was working on this with Altemeyer and reading study after study and talking to many of the authors, you know, was it nature or nurture, if you will? And the best anyone can tell, it's both. There is maybe a disposition that a person is born with, that their experiences result in them developing certain traits they might not otherwise. So it's totally individualistic and unpredictable. You can't say that it is either, because it's both.
Right. Now, one of the things that I'm sure has troubled you and troubled many of us who are working feverishly to defend democracy is that the followers seem to be far more numerous than we ever imagined. It's not simply the people who work for Trump. It's not a few hundred people. It's not even the people who show up at the rallies. It appears to be millions of Americans. Do they all fall within the follower category, or are some of them just go-alongers who are in it kind of for the thrill or for the pageantry of it all? How do you parse the Trump followers?
Jen, when I did the second book, which was many years later, it was just before Trump ran for re-election, Authoritarian Nightmare, Trump and His Followers, which I collaborated with Altemeyer. And I really, in that effort, wanted to get his science out there and just make sure it was written in a form that everybody would find readable and not overly academic, and sort of make it clearly for the general reader, which we did. And Altemeyer sadly passed away recently. And to do that book, I talked to Patrick Murray, who is the head of the Monmouth Polling Institute. And so we, for the first time, Altemeyer was able to, working with Monmouth polling people, to test nationally for right-wing authoritarianism, to see what was out there, and for social dominance as well as a host of other tests we put in this national survey. It was tested first in New Jersey, where Monmouth is located, to see if it would work as a online poll, if people could stick with it, if they'd do it right, if you'd get legitimate answers and what have you. And it was successful at the state level, so we did a national poll, and it was stunning, the results.
What did you find?
What I found is that we found that there is a surprisingly high number of people who are right-wing authoritarian followers. The social dominators remain a small number. Some of them found many more double highs than anticipated, where they test high on both scores. But about somewhere between 35 and 40% of the population shows traits of authoritarian followers. So it is a big number, and it is a significant number. It's why you found Trump would have 50 million plus voters that are right there with him. The details of a summary of the polling is in the book, and as I say, for Altmaier it was a career capping event because he realized the validity of his studies. First of all, he realized my intuitive sense that there were more of them around than we thought, and we should understand them better than we do, was right on. And to me, I'm still somewhat stunned that we don't pay more attention to who these people are and what they need and why they are the way they are.
Many other...
So I thank you for addressing the subject.
Well, thank you. It's fascinating to me. Some other people who have studied the Christian right, national movements, and Christian white nationalists have pointed out that there's a high overlap between what you're describing, which is a kind of a set of personality dispositions, and a religious movement in which a strict hierarchy is enforced. Men at the top, women at the bottom. Kind of a literalism about their faith, a lack of choice or of discretion of the followers. Fundamentalism, if you will. Were you able to line up those two things, a fundamentalist religious viewpoint with the authoritarian follower?
Absolutely. These are the core of the religious right, has become the core of today's modern day authoritarian follower, and as well as social dominators come right out of these religious movements. They are the authoritarian personality today. That's what they are, the dominant groups that they often have different leaders. I'm sure that those who are in Scientology don't talk to those who are in the Falwell School when he was their leader. And I must say, I don't follow the religious right as closely as I used to when my former colleague was trying to solicit me to become a born again member of his cult.
Yes. So do you think there's a cause and effect here? In other words, do you think people who have been raised in this religion become much more respectful or submissive to authority? Or do you think a person who is naturally inclined towards followership and a strict hierarchy finds a place in these churches? Which way do you think it goes?
I suspect that some of both, that those who are uncomfortable in life may find their way into a religious movement and find comfort there. Others who are part of the movement have reached out and incorporated politics as part of their own thinking. I apologize for my telephone ringing.
It's quite all right. It is interesting that it's taken until 2015, 2016, for a movement such as this to coalesce. What factors do you think made these people, if you will, even crazier than they were, even more desirous of a leader to such an extent that they would follow someone who's really emotionally, mentally unbalanced, as Donald Trump is, I think? Was it a set of factors, you think, in American society? Was it something that happened in the economy or in the life of religious people? What do you think kind of gelled this into such a potent political movement?
Well, I think it's been growing for decades now. I saw it in its very early phases while still at the Nixon White House. I saw it blossom post-Watergate quietly, not necessarily politically, in religious movements and the religious right as it grew, taking subjects like abortion and making them central to all their thinking and their activities that were political. I've watched it, and it was to me significant enough by 2005-06 that I said this book has to be done to explain who these people are, how conservatism has been twisted from where it was to what it's become, and it's really they are. I wasn't calling it a cult. Because social science wasn't calling it a cult at that time, but social science has certainly pegged these people for a long time and known who they were and how they respond and what they need and what they don't need. I followed it onward, and whenever I saw Trump arrive, he triggered something that had not happened. He made it okay to be out there and politically active with these beliefs, and he gave it a legitimacy that it didn't otherwise have. I don't think that he planned that. He sort of discovered it when he got out there. It wasn't something that was preordained. It was just a coincidence that, you know, he would have been a Democrat if that could have gotten him elected. He was once pro-choice, and now he's pro-life, so whatever. He's a pure opportunist, which a good social dominator is. They are very opportunistic, and we've had other people of that ilk. They're demagogues that have come along and triggered pretty sizable movements. And Trump, just his timing was perfect. We just haven't dealt effectively with it as a result of not wanting to look to see what really was there. In fact, one of the reasons the senator and I came up with the title of Conservatives Without Conscience was because to call somebody a few years ago an authoritarian was to like calling them a Nazi or whatever. Right. It was very degrading, and publishers sort of shied from it. And I did that book with my publishing house, and I remember talking to my editor about the initial title. I said, I want to address authoritarianism. He said, oh, God, don't use that for a title. And of course, that's when I came up with the Conservatives Without Conscience. It was a New York Times bestseller, as my paperback edition has across the top of it. But the authoritarian nightmare sold just because people by then, when I did that book in 2016, what's the pub date on that? 2020, just when that came out. That title, by then everybody recognized there are these people and personalities out there. What I'm working on right now is to try to get the people who study authoritarian governments to talk more with the people who study authoritarian personalities and get them together and draw from both of them, because it's the personalities who are attracted to these types and forms of government. And it seems to me a subject that needs to be explored quickly.
Absolutely. Is there a solution to this? In other words, is there a way of breaking the tie between the followers and the leaders? It may not be possible to, other than voting them out, to get rid of the social dominators. But is there a way of addressing the people who are followers in such a way that they begin to exercise some independent judgment and view these people more critically?
This has been a repetitive question I've had of all the social scientists I've worked with on this subject. Yeah. Is there anything we can do about these people? Do they understand and appreciate the threat they could hold to the way our system is supposed to function and the way they think about it, particularly today? And the answer I sadly have gotten is no. There are a few on the fringe who don't realize they're authoritarian followers and don't want to be what they are, and they will change their ways. The overwhelming majority of authoritarian followers are what they are and really can't change. They will rationalize their behavior. They will compartmentalize to a comfort level that they can live with. They are what they are. And the only way you can deal with them in a political context is where they long resided, which is to be uncomfortable being what they are and to remain hidden. And that's where they were for decades. They've always been there. The problem is that they have now found a legitimacy in somebody like Trump, and they're unbelievably to me, the Republican Party has completely capitulated to letting the authoritarians dominate and control the party. It is an authoritarian party today. The streaks that I reported on and back in Conservatives Without Conscience is now the mainstream MAGA movement.
Right. There is a study that was done, I think relatively recently, that there was one of these groups that was predicting the end of the world. I mean, it was the Mayan calendar or some such thing. And when the end of the world didn't come, people went back to them and said, well, do you see now that this was not true? And they said, oh, no, 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 we made a mistake. And they went through every kind of rationalization to explain why their belief system was absolutely correct, and they would come up with some other date or new date. So the ability to present facts and to reason with people who are so caught up in a movement like this seems to be very limited. What can we do other than defeat them and show that perhaps their great leader is not invincible? You know, the God bleeds, Trump loses. Is that the only way to do it, or will they still follow him to the ends of the earth, believing whatever the results of the election, that he's really the winner?
Social science shows they'll follow to the end of the earth. It's a sad but true reality, and that's why this election is particularly important. The best solution is to vote them out of power, to keep them out of power, because they will abuse power once they're there. It's just a reality, and that's why we have a particularly important election. As I say, for a long time, it was unacceptable behavior, and people stayed out of the public arena, if you will, taking these causes and way of thinking to the point it's arrived today. So the only way to get it back where under a rock, if you will, is by the power of the ballot box. And that's certainly my goal, is
Absolutely.
To do it. And the good news is, Jen, is there are more of us than there are of them.
Right.
And they are, they cannot take control of the country if the country does not want them to control. They are the tyranny of the minority.
Right.
And we can be the majority, as has long been the case, where these people have been pushed to the sideline or under a rock.
When you see other historical fascist movements, authoritarian movements, there is always a class of people that what I call enablers. It's the church, it's big business, and they think they can use the social dominators to cut deals, to get what they want. And so they wind up, even though they are cynical and don't believe the ideology, kind of helping it along. And when I see someone like Jamie Dimon, who is a financial wizard, apparently, say that Trump would be fine, I cannot help but think of the industrialists in Nazi Germany or the Catholic Church that was infamous for being passive in the face of Hitler. How do those sorts of people figure into your calculus?
Well, they trouble me because there's no question there are people who are opportunists. They're often social dominators in their own world. They're not necessarily followers. The social dominator, as I say, will, or the double high, as social science calls them, will go along to get along because they think that they indeed can have their turn to lead the pack, if you will, and to take charge. So they're always out there. But what the solution is, Trump, for example, gets his power not because he's this great charismatic character, but he has convinced enough people to follow him that they are his power. It's not Trump himself. It's the following he's got that will do his will. The people who would go so far as to do a riot on the Capitol on January 6th. I think the greatest disappointment he's currently experiencing is he can't get these people to, he can't conjure them up into a crowd of troublemakers at his trials or
exactly.
to go to different, any place other than his rallies where they cheer him. That's because a lot of people do have, while they might have the instincts to want to do it, they also don't want to lose their freedom, and they're not all stupid. But there have always been these problems. Nixon was an authoritarian personality, but not to the degree of opportunism that Trump has taken it. George Wallace was conspicuous. We've had very few presidents who were pure authoritarian people or personalities, but we've had them, and they have. Andrew Jackson was probably the most notorious pre-Trump, but Trump has certainly just following his own instincts. And you know, I did not find a lot of narcissism in these studies, and I'm actually plan to go back and look and see if this is a very common personality trait, but there has always been some. You don't become a demagogue because you're a wallflower.
Right.
That's clear. So, I think that it's the ballot box that's got to resolve this, and getting people to understand the underlying nature of our being, and you know, the way these personalities interact. Clearly, it is the authoritarian followers who let us slip into fascism and anti-democratic governments. I've not also looked at the foreign studies because they need translation often to see what's happening in countries like Hungary and Turkey and other places where clearly authoritarians have taken charge, to see if the social scientists there are still studying these subjects at all, to see and learn more about the underlying problems. We know that the political scientists are looking at them from a distance, but as I say, I think these two bodies of science belong together.
Fascinating. Well, it sounds like the basis of a very, very important conference and collaboration. Well, John, it has been fascinating, and I can only hope that you are traveling the country explaining, especially to young people who disengage or they find fault with President Biden or they fault with democracy, how vital it is for them to engage in politics. Because when we say democracy is on the ballot, it's not a cliche, it's a reality. We have an absolute fork in the road here. Do we want to go down this road of authoritarianism or don't we?
Yes, I think ignorance is one of the large issues. Clearly, democracy takes a lot of tending. When you were talking about Jamie Dimon, there's yes. also a lot of naivete by people who are successful. They think they understand the system, and they really don't know very well how it works. I was not particularly concerned about Trump during his first term. I'm deeply concerned about a second term. You have people like the Heritage Foundation becoming umbrella foundations for planning a pure authoritarian second term for this man, recruiting bodies who are right thinking in their mind to fill all of the administrative jobs in the executive branch. The only seed I've seen that is outside of this that kind of hints at it is those, the law professors who've been cranking out for years now law journal articles about the unitary executive theory, which is to me another way to describe authoritarian government. So all this is coming together at a very, very propitious time, and it's going to be a very important election to resolve these issues.
Well, thank you, John, for coming and educating us. Please keep up your work, and please bring these two bodies together, because it sounds like they have a lot to talk about.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you for your good work, your daily work, actually.
Thank you. And that was John Dean. Wow. It's a little bit sobering, because all of what we hear is, oh, if we only respected these people, if we were only nicer to them, then the MAGA forces wouldn't be so angry, wouldn't be so resentful. If we just gave them something that they wanted, they would behave like normal voters. But what John is saying, and I think he is right, is that they want something we can't give them. They want an authoritarian society. They want someone to tell them what to do. They want someone to beat up on their enemies. They want someone to deprive other people of their constitutional rights. They want someone else to refract back their worst instincts, their worst behavior, their worst prejudices. And we can't give that to them. If we give them that, we cease to be America. We cease to be a democracy. We cease to be a decent, honorable society. And we cannot give them that. There is no compromise. There's only a defeat. And so when I see people say, oh, I'm mad at Biden because I don't like the way he's handled the Gaza war, or I'm mad at Biden because he really hasn't done enough on climate change, or he's too old, or whatever the other thousand excuses are, you can understand why I have so little patience for that. We are talking about the survival of American democracy. And I personally think Joe Biden has been a very good president. He's helped the economic recovery. We have the best economy in the world by far. He has led us back into a leadership position in the world. He's passed crucial legislation. But even if you thought all those things were bad, or you think he's done a whole bunch of other stuff you don't like, it would still be better than turning our society over to a narcissistic, authoritarian personality and the shock troops that follow him. So when you're explaining to your friends, your family members, why it's important to vote, I hope you can take something from this conversation and explain to them that not everyone in America believes in democracy. We used to say things like, oh, this isn't who we are. Well, it's part of who we are. And unless the part of us who believes in freedom, in choice, in intellectual discovery, in creativity, in engagement, in pluralism, if we don't get our act together, the authoritarians are going to prevail. So it's all up for grabs. Please vote. Please get your friends and family to vote. Please give your time and your money to causes that boost democracy, that boost the rule of law. And if you do that, we'll keep our democracy. So thank you again for joining us. If you like the program and you think your friends might like it, please tell them. They can follow us on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, or on YouTube, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.